They are elected by you. I am elected by you. I'm constrained as they are constrained by a system that our founders put in place.
The founders separated power because they knew it was the best way to protect our citizens.
They didn't want one person, one man to have all the power like a king.
We show by our work that free people can govern themselves.
You can't pay lip service to the Constitution without obeying it.
Keep your eye on the ball. Structure is destiny.
This is Necessary and Proper, the podcast of the Federal Society's Article 1 Initiative. All views expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Federal Society. Hello, this is Nate Kaczmarek. Thank you for listening to the Necessary and Proper podcast. On June 11th, the Article 1 Initiative was pleased to partner with the Federal Society's DC Young Lawyers chapter to host Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa to share his thoughts and reflections on the nominations process, the Article 1 Initiative, and the current state of the legislative branch. Senator Grassley will soon be the longest-serving Republican in the Senate, and he had much to share. We hope you enjoy the senator's address.
I'm pleased to be here to visit with you tonight about two things. If I don't touch on things you're interested in, I'll have a few minutes for a few Q&As if you want to ask me questions. The two things are the president's and the Senate's success in reshaping the judiciary, and the second one, the importance of Congress reasserting its constitutional powers. Many of you are in law school or recent law school graduates, and you're lucky if the Federalist Society has a presence on your law school campus. 36 years ago, when this society was formed, it was about as hard to find conservative legal ideas at the top law schools as it is now to find the Senate in session, especially on Fridays. 36 years ago, you would have been hard-pressed to find a place to honestly debate separation of powers or the weight to weigh the values of textualism and originalism and maybe a whole lot of other things. Obviously, we're still outnumbered, but your society, the Federalist Society, is helping turn the tide, and every day I'll bet, making a difference. Over the three decades, the Federalist Society has encouraged law students to put its ideas to a test and has made its case effectively to the American public. I think the last presidential election and 20% of the voters following what Trump said he was going to do about people for the Supreme Court and the judgeships generally backs up the fact that somebody's making a big difference. For too long, liberal judges oftentimes just made up the law based on their personal policy preferences, while ignoring the plain text of the law duly enacted by the people's representatives in Congress. And now, 36 years on, the Federalist Society has proved the power of its ideas and helped steer our judiciary away from these radical and unconstitutional approaches to legal interpretation that judges must apply the law. They don't get to write it. And there's hardly a hearing or debate about judges where you really sense the power of the Federalist Society because you're just lampooned all the time by people on the left that maybe some of these nominees had something to do with the Federalist Society. And it's a god-awful thing that could happen. And I never quite heard that even from Republicans, that in the previous administration, maybe all of our nominees had a great deal to do with something called the ACLU. So you can see the double standard. Now I'm going to rattle off some facts and figures about our success confirming qualified conservative judges, what we've been accomplishing in the Senate Judiciary Committee and on the Senate floor speaks to a much larger issue. What kind of a country do we want to have? What I believe, and what I'm sure you believe, is that we're a nation of law, not a government, or a government of men or men and women. An independent judiciary that understands its role as the least dangerous branch, and you know where those words came from, is critical to sustaining the rule of law and our constitutional republic. Judges should say what the law is, not what they think it should be. Decades of building this vision by the Federalist Society members helped lead to this moment or this period of time when we're making this difference in not only the number of people getting nominated by the president, but also the type. We have a president then appointing textualists and originalist judges, and a Republican Senate majority actively confirming them. And of course, as you know, the results speak for themselves. Last year, the Senate confirmed Justice Gorsuch. He's proven himself a worthy successor to the late Justice Scalia, a person that probably history's already said is one of the greatest justices of all times. Now, to date, we have confirmed 21 circuit judges, so Leonard, you're right. A record at this point in any president's first term. That would be true at least in the period of time since 1890s when the circuit courts were set up. We're confident that this Congress will confirm at least 30 circuit judges by the time we adjourn in December. Maybe do a little bit more, because if we're going to meet through the month of August, we'll have time to have more hearings that we didn't work into our schedule. So, Mike, if you haven't figured that out, we want some hearings for judges during the month of August.
Yes, sir.
We will confirm more than half that number in just 2 years compared to President Obama's appointment of 55 circuit judges in 8 years. So, we're going to get the job done, I think. Even so, all of this hasn't been easy. Referring to what the Democrats have done, as you know, they've engaged in unprecedented levels of obstruction. They have required time wasting cloture votes on 39 judicial nominees, even for those who were eventually confirmed unanimously. Last week, today and tomorrow, a week ago, we confirmed judges by 95-0 votes, and they had to be filibustered. So what's up? The whole point is to pour sand into the gears of government because they don't want this president to succeed. Now, to compare what I said about 39, at the same time, in the previous administration, we had just 2 cloture votes on Republican judges. Now, maybe some of you conservatives said, well, how come we weren't fighting as hard as the Democrats were doing? Well, I guess because of the comedy of the Senate that doesn't seem to exist anymore, but even a few years ago, it seemed to exist. There are currently 49 nominees processed through the Senate Judiciary Committee and pending on the Senate floor, awaiting confirmation vote of the full Senate. That's 3 circuit courts, 38 district court, 2 Article I court, 4 main justice appointees, and 2 other executive branch nominees. And this number will keep growing as the Senate Judiciary Committee keeps voting out more nominees to the Senate floor every Thursday that the Senate is in session. I support Senator Lankford's proposal to reform the Senate rules so the Senate Democrats cannot continue to abuse the confirmation process. I think I have to have a drink of water. In the meantime, we simply need to outwork the Senate Democrats to stop this unprecedented obstruction. That is why I repeatedly urged Leader McConnell to cancel the August recess. I guess he thought it was a good idea, but now we'll be working for the American people during most of August. The Senate Democrats claim that they need more floor time for floor speeches. Well, their wish is granted now. They'll have the whole month of August. They now, we shouldn't stop at canceling the August recess. The Senate generally starts its late session, its sessions late on Monday afternoon and go back out of session on Thursday afternoons. And you know, kindergartens and preschool kids have longer session than we have. Hey, I just got to put this in perspective. So maybe somebody's going to have 1 minute less to ask a question. But, you know, when I came to the United States Senate, everybody wanted to know from the leader, whether he's Republican or Democrat, are we going to be able to get on a 4 o'clock flight Friday afternoon? And then maybe after 10 or 15 years, can we get on a flight about 1 o'clock in the afternoon? And then can we get on a flight at 8 o'clock Friday morning? Then it was later on, well, can we get on a late Thursday flight? See, and now it's everybody wants to get on a 4 o'clock flight on Thursday afternoon. I'm telling you, it's just like a slippery slope. It gets worse and worse. So somebody's suggesting, can't we have all the votes on Wednesdays, so we don't have to come in on Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday? Now, I shouldn't have done that because I lost my spot. I have repeatedly urged Leader McConnell to end our French work week and keep the Senate in session Monday through Friday, evenings and weekends as needed, until we complete the job of confirming these judges. I think it's pretty simple. Maybe in a week or two, the Democrats will decide we want some time to campaign in August. So maybe they'll start letting us get some of these judges that are approved 95-0 on a voice vote like they used to be done. So maybe we can have a summer break. There's plenty to do if we weren't doing judges, but I'm just suggesting that maybe this will wake them up when Leader McConnell says, I'm in charge and this is what we're going to do. We're going to get the job done. It's amazing how many judges we can confirm by merely threatening to make the Senate Democrats work past 2 p.m. on Thursdays. The resistance cannot resist long weekends. In all seriousness, our hard work now is critically important to the future of the country. Our success in confirming judges will have a significant impact on the courts. Had Hillary Clinton been elected with a Democrat majority in the Senate, we would be stuck with a liberal majority on the Supreme Court for a generation, just like we hope we're getting ready for a generation of people like Gorsuch. And it's likely that activist judges would have taken over the Fifth, the Sixth, and the Seventh Circuits. Instead, we've confirmed dozens of young constitutionalist judges to the federal branch. These judges will influence the direction of law for a generation, and we have the incredible opportunity to reduce the influence of activist judges on the Ninth Circuit for the first time in years. Maybe if we get that job done, they won't be reversed so many times. Now that I've covered our success on the courts, I want to discuss something else just as important, our role in Congress in checking the powers of the administrative state, to deal with the size of our country and the complexities of the modern world, Congress has had to delegate some of its powers to federal agencies. It's a compromise made in the name of efficiency. The government has a big job to do, and we've only got a few hundred legislators and a limited amount of time to do it, but it's a compromise fraught with peril, and I'm sure all of you think about this. The only area where I think it's legitimate is when scientific issues are involved. Maybe there's some other issues, but I always think in terms of science. Maybe there's some more leeway you gotta give, but on too many policy decisions, Congress just, I think they almost forgot how to bite the bullet. Are we really delegating too much authority or not? Not even thinking about it, just seems to happen. And getting people to think about it, I think would go a long ways in curbing some of this delegation of our power. And then once you delegate it, it's hard to get it back. When the compromise works well, we get government that's responsive to the evolving needs of our country. When it doesn't, we get agencies that regulate every aspect of our lives with unchecked power and without real input from the American people. Bureaucrats, as you know, don't have to win elections to keep their jobs. So the American people cannot hold them directly responsible for their actions. You do through the president, but big government is too much for even the best of a president to watch everything that's going on in it. The courts have not been helpful here, deferring to agency bureaucrats' interpretation of the statutes when they're challenged in the court. What that means is executive agencies obtain executive, legislative, judicial functions all wrapped up in one. They make regulations, interpret those regulations, and enforce those regulations. Which brings to mind Madison's famous caution in Federalist 47 that, quote, the accumulation of all powers, legislative, executive, and judicial, in the same hands, may justly be pronounced the very definition of tyranny. In other words, as he knew it, George III. Fortunately, Madison, having identified the problem, also points us to a solution, a tripartite form of government in which ambition counteracts ambition. And here is where the Federalist Society has ridden in again to help save the day. I hope all of you are now familiar with the Federalist Society's excellent Article One initiative. Probably some of you in this room are involved in it. The project is dedicated to helping Congress assert its traditional constitutional prerogatives and checks against the other branches. It proposes reining in the Chevron deference. I'm a co-sponsor of a bill to do that, I think with Senator Hatch, as I recall. An aggressive and strategic use of Congress's legislative taxing and spending powers. But even the Article I initiative doesn't pay enough attention, in my view, to one of Congress's most important powers, the power of oversight. If Congress is going to delegate some of its power to the executive agencies, it has a duty to the American people to closely monitor what the agencies do with that power. It's through rigorous constitutional oversight that we can make the agencies accountable to the American people. Rigorous oversight is the basis for good law and efficient use of American tax dollars. It also helps prevent government fraud, waste, and abuse. It's a key part of keeping the administrative state in check. Oversight responsibility belongs not just to the committee's ranking member and me, belongs to each individual member of Congress. It also belongs to government and corporate employees who have become aware of unlawful conduct or waste, fraud, and abuse, which is why I have worked hard to pass legislation protecting whistleblowers. They must be protected so their voices are heard. And I want to tell you that I don't think there's a single nominee that are on that come before the committees I serve on, that they if they come to my office, and most of them do ahead of time for get acquainted with them, I say something like this. I don't know how many employees you got. You could be VA with 300,000 or 400,000 employees. You could be, another agency with just 10,000 employees. But either you're going to run your agency or it's going to run you. And if you need, if you're going to run it, you got to know what's going on below. But there's no way you can overlook all the people that are under your jurisdiction, whether it's 10,000 or whether it's 400,000. And so you ought to have respect for whistleblowing and listen to whistleblowers. Now, there's not a single one that leaves my office that doesn't say that they know about the importance of whistleblower and they're going to encourage whistleblowing and listen to whistleblower. But they all end up being liars, or if they aren't lying, they may have intentions to carry it out, but they forget it, or they got so many other things to do. But I don't know how you can run this big government we have when there's honest, patriotic people that we call whistleblowers, which tends to be somewhat negative towards them. And it shouldn't be. Everyone I know, well, maybe once in a while you get a crank, somebody to axe the grind or something, as we say in Iowa. But really, most of them that I know, they don't even know they're whistleblowers until they don't get any, they go up through the chain of command and they don't get any results. Then they come to Congress. That's when they become whistleblowers. Most of them ruin themselves professionally. They shouldn't have to do that. Just because you want the government to spend the money the way the government intends to spend, the law says they should spend it, or enforce the laws the way it should be done. They're just people that want government to do what government's supposed to do. And somehow you're just like a skunk at a picnic. You ruin yourself professionally. There's great peer pressure to go along, to get along in every bureaucracy. And by golly, I don't know how we're going to run this government if you don't pay. When people say something's wrong, you ought to be doing something about it. So it's not that I like whistleblowers, it's that they're very essential. And you know, on July the 29th, 1779 or 78, the Continental Congress passed a resolution because these sailors were thrown out of the Navy or something because they reported on some captain of some ship ruining money. I guess they were absolved of whatever they were punished for. But the point is that the Continental Congress passed this. You call it laws in those days. They passed something that said, if you know of wrongdoing in the government, it's your responsibility to report it. So government's recognition of the importance of people squealing on other people that do something wrong goes way back to the Continental Congress. So every July 29th or 28th, whenever it is, I recognize that with a resolution. So that's how I feel is what's wrong with our government. Now, George W. Bush told me one time when I was on Air Force One that I told him you ought to listen to these whistleblowers. He said if we started listening to these whistleblowers, we'd have whistleblowers coming out of the woodwork. Well, that's exactly why I told him you ought to have a Rose Garden ceremony recognizing whistleblowers. Because from the top of the government down to the lowest levels of government, and that's the president down to whatever the lowest level of government is, they know that the patriotic things to do is when the law isn't being enforced, get it enforced. That's how I feel about it. And I didn't appreciate a guy that I liked as president of the United States saying that you shouldn't have a Rose Garden ceremony recognizing whistleblowers, because 3,000 of them will come out of the woodwork. Well, why do you think I suggested you have the Rose Garden ceremony? So when I get my breath back, I will say I encourage you and the rest of the Federalist Society to push for more congressional oversight in our constitutional system. Many of you out there will be leaders, maybe members of Congress, but working somewhere in one of the branches of our government. If you work in the executive branch, I encourage you to respond to oversight letters promptly from members of Congress, even if it comes from the other side of the aisle. If you work in the judicial branch, I encourage you to defer to congressional intent, as evidenced by the plain text and original public meaning of the law when interpreting statutes, and to support Congress's oversight efforts. And if you work in the legislative branch, I encourage you to wield your oversight power like a sword to cut away waste, fraud, and abuse, to bend the bureaucratic will to the American people. Thank you, and I'm ready for Q&A. Yeah.
I'm Will Trackman from the Department of Education. Thank you so much for your remarks. As Leonard mentioned, you're going to be the longest serving senator after Senator Hatch retires. That comes along with the title President Pro Tempore of the Senate. You'll be three heartbeats away from the presidency. I was just wondering if you have any thoughts about that or your long tenure on the Senate.
Yeah. Now just think of what he said. Three heartbeats away from being president. Let's just suppose the president, the vice president, and the speaker of the House all disappear one day. Who would want to be president of the United States in those circumstances? Okay, next question. Yeah.
Nick Gallagher, NYU Law. Senator, when you think about the effective oversight, models for long-term reform, and the Article I Project, there are very few options that don't involve significant expansion of Congress's staff, both in terms of the numbers and in terms of the ability to raise wages so that people can stick around long enough to develop expertise. Do you ever see a Congress that would actually do that? And if not, if that is as politically unpalatable as it sounds, how might we go about fixing it?
Yeah. I suppose a fiscal conservative, and some people might question whether I fall into that category, but as a fiscal conservative, I think that you don't expand Congress just because the bureaucracy expanded or how big the job is. I just think you got to figure out the job to do and have the people to get the job done, but it shouldn't be an end in itself, just hiring more people because the bureaucracy might be a little bigger. Next question. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for your time tonight and for all the wonderful things you have done for this country as a public servant. One of the things that has been on my mind is that many of the venerable formal or informal institutions of the Senate, the filibuster, the 30-hour rule, the blue slip, seem to have become perverted to subvert what the Senate should be doing, which is deliberating on the problems of the people. And I was wondering if you could comment on those in particular and what we can do to reform those things such that the Senate gets back to its job of deliberating on problems rather than using filibusters and blue slips to prevent consideration and deliberation of nominees as well as issues present to the day.
Since I'm 84 years old, I think what I'm going to tell you isn't going to happen during my lifetime. But I think that this whole situation has to start with individual senators performing different and setting good examples, and eventually it works its way through the system and we might get back to something that is more efficient and doing its job and yet be a deliberative body. And the only thing that maybe you might suggest that I disagree with, if you did suggest this, and I'm not sure you did, but if you were hinting towards doing away with the 60-vote rule or a supermajority, that's one thing that I would not agree with. But within that, and the reason why I wouldn't want to do that is because in our political system, the only place where there's minority points of view can be heard is within the United States Senate. And I don't think we should write out the minority point of view and have the Senate become like the House of Representatives. And obviously, for those of us that are conservative, if we hadn't had the supermajority, we wouldn't have right-to-work laws because we wouldn't have the Taft-Hartley law anymore after the unions control everything with 51 votes. And I could probably name 10 other major pieces of legislation that conservative filibusters have probably saved or long. So except for that, then I think that the Democrats have really reformed the blue slip on their own. And I get blamed for its use or how it's being used now, which isn't any different than two out of the 19 chairmen of the committee in the 100 years of the blue slip. Every one of them have had some exceptions. But the Democrats are really obliterated the value of the blue slip when they went to a 51 vote for judges. So that's where that has been compromised. But I don't consider that a compromise of what I previously told you about minority point of views, because if you go between 1789 and about 2002 or 3, there wasn't judges filibustered. Now, somebody will say, well, Abe Fortas was, but he only had 48 votes to begin with. So he wouldn't have got elected if it wasn't filibustered. And so it started with the Democrats thinking they were cheated out of Gore being president of the United States. So they took on this crusade in 2002 and 3 that we can bring ideology and politics into this whole thing rather than just looking at, is somebody qualified, see? And so that's where we got where we are with judges. You can tell how sorry they are that they changed the rules November 2013, because all these judges that are getting through now, the same people wouldn't have gotten through. There's probably 100 more things I ought to tell you, but thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening to Necessary and Proper. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell a friend, and don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play. To learn more about the Article I initiative, please visit fedsoc.org/articlei. That's fedsoc.org/articlei.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.